San Francisco. I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. When new scientific developments seem to contradict personal religious beliefs, we all take a step back and look carefully at the information before us. Does this new information shake the core of our beliefs, or can we, in fact, reconcile them? Francis Crick is best known for co-discovering the double helix structure of DNA. He has moved on from this Nobel Prize-winning work to look at what science can find out about human consciousness. We'll talk to him about his latest book and his scientific search for the soul. I'll also speak with Doris Hamburg. As head of paper conservation for the Library of Congress, she is serving as the conservator for the Dead Sea Scrolls exhibition. She'll tell us what these scrolls are made of and how they're protected on their travels. She'll also tell us what it's like to hold one in your hands. Commonly held beliefs shape our perspectives in life independent of the truth. Just think back to when everyone thought the Earth was flat. Francis Crick's latest book, The Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul, looks at the latest scientific investigations of how the brain relates to human consciousness. I asked him if we had to prepare ourselves for a major paradigm shift given what we're learning about the brain.
Well, I think we have to prepare ourselves, but one must realize that the idea that everything's about you, your character and your feelings and your behavior happens in the brain, goes back to Hippocrates in the 4th century BC. So it's not exactly a new idea. And moreover, quite a lot of people today, especially scientists and medical men and so on, they don't believe in the soul in the way that many, say, Christians do. But you'd be surprised how many ordinary people believe in the literal existence of the soul. They shouldn't worry too much, I think, yet about whether their ideas are right or wrong, because it's really just a hypothesis that it's all in the brain. And what we want to do is to try and see how to prove that.
I think there are two words in the title to your book which need to be understood the most, and that's hypothesis and soul. What does it mean to bring about a hypothesis, and what do you mean by soul?
Well, hypothesis is a standard scientific word for a very tentative theory about something. Before you embark on anything scientific, you must have a rough idea of how you think it works, and that's usually called a hypothesis. As scientific knowledge increases, the hypothesis becomes more and more certain. You can never prove, of course, something is absolutely true, but it comes to the stage where it's true beyond reasonable doubt. When you come to soul, it's more complicated because soul is used in two different ways. Soul is used in the metaphorical sense, meaning essentially your character and your deep feelings and things of that sort. That's not going to go away. We human beings will always be like that. The other use of the soul is that it's something immaterial. And that, of course, again has a long history, but was rather clearly put by Descartes, the philosopher Descartes, who made a firm distinction between the material things happening in your brain and the immaterial things happening in the soul. And he thought they interacted in a particular part of your head, the pineal gland, which I don't think people now believe. But there are still people, including scientists, who believe that really we are a disembodied spirit who's interacting with our brains. And the astonishing hypothesis says that that's probably not true.
Why is that?
Why do we think that? Well, I think really because we know so much about atoms and molecules and nerve cells and the way the brain behaves when you look into it, that it doesn't seem very plausible there should be something else. But on the other hand, if I had to argue with somebody, I can't produce at the moment scientific evidence which is so strong that I can say that I think the hypothesis is true. But I can produce enough evidence to make it plausible.
Why did you pick the concept of soul, not just life? Or why didn't you just look at the brain?
Well, you see, you shouldn't just say life, because a thing like bacteria, like Escherichia coli, which you have in your gut, are normally considered to be alive. People argue as to whether you should think of the virus as alive, but everybody would agree the bacterium is alive. And I don't think there's very few people who think that a bacterium has a soul. So there is a distinction between the two. So that's why we kept off alive. And I suppose I could have said soul or spirit. The more normal thing would have been to have put in the word consciousness somewhere. But there have been quite a number of books recently with consciousness in the title, and most of the things you could think of have already been used by other people, you know, like consciousness explained and this sort of thing.
In the book, you took visual awareness systems. You say, let's talk about that as we relate it to consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little about that.
Well, if you want to approach the problem of consciousness scientifically, there are roughly speaking two ways. You can either look at all possible aspects of consciousness, because, of course, it takes different forms. You can be conscious of pain, consciousness of how you see things or hear things, and also complicated things like self-consciousness. So it probably takes different forms, and you could perhaps worry about all of those and worry about hypnosis and transcendental meditation and things of that sort. And some people do that approach. In my opinion, that's a dangerous thing to do biologically, because biological mechanisms, because they've evolved, they're a series of bits of gadgetry, really, and simple explanations don't always work. And we can see that if we were to think about memory, which we now know takes different forms, and so on. The other approach, which is the one that my colleague Christoph Koch and I prefer, is to try and work out, well, perhaps all these forms of consciousness have something in common, and wouldn't it be more sensible to go for the one which we would think, of course it's a matter of opinion, we would think is the one that's likely to yield the most easily to a scientific attack. And for various reasons, we chose the visual system, how we see. For example, we're very visual animals. We and the apes and the monkeys, the primates that is, have got good vision, whereas mammals as a whole have got poor vision. Birds have often got good vision. That was one thing. And the other thing is that the visual input is very rich, as you can see by just looking around the world in front of you. And yet you can control it, the input, if you're doing experiments on people and animals. And for this reason, a very large amount of experimental work has been done on it, and that seemed to us to provide a good foundation. So that's why we chose vision. And then the problem comes is, what goes on in our heads when we see? Simple enough question, but not so easy to answer.
Now, how does our vision relate to our consciousness?
Well, most people would feel that we're not automata. That's to say, the input doesn't just come into our eyes and then we behave. We actually see. And that's essentially, you can call it awareness or consciousness. There is a distinction between the two, but it's a very fine one. And so we think that what has to be explained. Now, when one tells people this, they can't see quite why, because they think that seeing must be so easy, because you open your eyes and you see everything in color and movement, and you're fairly sure it's true, because if you walk across the room, there the thing is. But you have to remember that although the object that on the other side of the room is out there, what you're seeing is inside your head. And that turns out to be quite a complicated business that your brain has to do to work out what it is that it's seeing.
How could you approach it experimentally?
Well, in the visual system, we believe there's at least one way of doing it, which is really quite powerful. There are certain things you can look at, which psychologists have invented, which when you look at them, they don't change, But you see them first in one way, and then a second or so later you see them in a second way, and then back to the first way. A typical one is what's called a Necker cube, a drawing of a cube with 12 lines. And you look at it, and very surprisingly, as you look, the aspect of the cube changes. You see this sort of thing in those drawings by Escher, for example, things which are ambiguous. Well, now you have a beautiful paradigm. That is to say, you take a person or an animal and you show them these things. Now, what's coming into their eyes is tolerably constant. But what they're perceiving, what they're seeing, is changing. First this, first that, and so on. And you can do this. You don't do it with a Necker cube. You do it on in the moment with fringes, with lines moving up in one eye and down in the other, and but superimposed in your vision. And under those conditions, you see first one and then the other, and so on. You can do that on a monkey, and the monkey can be taught, trained to tell you: are they going up? Is he seeing things going up, or is he things going down? And he alternates much the same way as you do. Then you can look inside the monkey's brain at the part which is concerned with movement and ask, what are the neurons doing? And some neurons you find are firing just the same, whatever the monkey is seeing, because they're the ones that, as it were, responding to what's coming in. But other ones are changing according to what the percept is. When he's seeing them go one way, then they'll be firing, and when he's seeing them the other way, they won't be. Those are the ones we are looking for. This is being done by Nikos Lokathetis, who works at Baylor in Houston, and there are results on that which have come out since the book was published, which do support some of the preliminary ideas in the book. So we do have it, and there are other ways along these lines, experimental ways which we can attack the problem. It's not something you just sit around all day talking about.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Dr. Francis Crick, well known for co-discovering the double helix structure of DNA. Dr. Crick's latest book is The Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul. You quote Napoleon's question to Pierre-Simon Laplace: where does God come into all of this? Well, Dr. Crick, where does God come into the scientific search for the soul?
Well, that was quoted in a slightly different context.
I know that.
But let me explain why. The point people say is, well, how will you ever disprove that there is a soul? All right. Not the question of God in this instance, which we can come back to. How would you disprove it? And the answer is that in a strict sense, it's very difficult to prove a negative. What you have to do is essentially to build up the scientific evidence to such a stage that it seems to explain everything. And that was the point of the exchange between Laplace and Napoleon, because, as he said, where does God come into all this? And Laplace replied, "Sir, I have no need of that hypothesis." So that's the stage we want to get to with the soul, that we don't have a need for the hypothesis. Now, you mustn't think that when you discuss the soul, you're necessarily also discussing the deity. Because, of course, there are Eastern religions, Buddhism is one, in which there isn't a deity, and yet they believe there is a spirit, which, say, can be reincarnated and eventually does other things. So the two are separate, although they're often linked together.
There are numerous references throughout about how the brain can be described as working much like a computer. Tell us about that.
Well, I think everybody would agree that in some loose sense, the brain is, or the bits of the brain we are interested in, is handling information. We're not terribly concerned with the energy the brain uses, although it does use a fair proportion of our energy. We are concerned with how the information in the outside world, and if we stick to vision in what is coming into our eyes, gets translated in some way into a symbolic representation inside our head of what's going out there. And of course, computers are concerned with information. It does appear, however, that our brain doesn't operate in the sort of way that most computers do days, the ordinary PC, for example. You don't have to write a program for the brain. If you were to write a program to be able to pronounce English or something like that, it would be a series of instructions to the computer, about whether the letter C should be hard or soft and things of that sort. That isn't the way that the brain works. There's another sort of computer nowadays called a neural network in which you have a learning rule, but you don't actually teach the rules of pronunciation. You merely tell this machine, this neural network, when it's doing well and when it's doing badly, and it learns. And if that's the way, of course, children learn a language. They learn to use the rules of grammar, but they can't tell you what the rules are. They have what's called tacit knowledge of it because they picked it up by experience. And that isn't the way that a computer normally works. And, of course, there are other differences. The elements in a computer work very much faster than the nerve cells in our brain. And the brain tries to compensate for that by having many operations going on in parallel, not just 16 or 32 or something like that, but millions. Going from your eye to your brain, each of your eyes to the brain, is a million nerve fibers, of which quite a reasonable proportion will be active at any one time. So it has slow components. But of course, it has to act quickly. It's no use. It has to act what's called in real time. It's no use waiting a long time to work out there if something out there is trying to eat you. So it has to be fast, and it's evolved using therefore many slow components in parallel, and that's why we have so many nerve cells inside our head. That and the fact we have to do many different complicated operations.
You say that what reaches our consciousness is the result of computations, though, inside our head.
That's the way that people who work in artificial intelligence like to talk about it. But that's just a way of talking about it. Of course, actually, it's a lot of signals going to and from the various nerve cells. And it's possible to argue that you should think of the operations of the brain as divided in these two ways. This is probably an oversimplification. The computations, which work out, you know, how you see in three dimensions from two-dimensional images and things of that sort, and then what you actually see, which is the result of all that. And it's easy for psychologists to show that you're not really aware, you're not conscious of how you see, you're conscious of what you see. What people differ about is whether the representation of what you see in your head is likely to be fairly simple. It won't be very simple, that's for sure. Whether it had to be fairly simple or whether that's also extremely complicated. We hope that the representation will be fairly simple. And I can make an analogy, but I wouldn't want it to be pushed too far. When you use your PC, your computer, you're not aware of what's going on inside the computer, but what you see is the results expressed on the screen. Now, that's not a fair analogy because you're looking at the screen, but it gets over the distinction between the computations and the results of the computations.
It's as if the data and the program is more important to you, and if in your own head, the information which you have and the processes, however that might work, is what really is bringing about the consciousness.
Well, you could again imagine that you had this data, but that you couldn't describe it. You couldn't talk about it. Your limbs moved in some way. And there are conditions in which, if you have certain brain damage, so that a person actually can't see in a part of their visual field, and yet if you test them by shining little lights when a buzzer goes, they can point to the lights. In other words, there's information coming into their eyes, and that this behavior as a result, pointing at the things, is called blindsight, and they deny they see it. So they are, in that sense, acting as an automaton, because they're not conscious of seeing. They would deny that they're seeing anything. But they can only do very simple things in this way. They can't read. They may be able to just distinguish the difference between a large letter X and a large letter O, for example. They certainly can't read a word. So presumably, why you need this visual awareness, this visual consciousness, is so that you can handle much more information. And, of course, the information then has to be sent out to other parts of the brain, to the part that deals with language and then the part that moves your muscles and so on. So it has to be used for something. Of course, you don't always do something as a result of what you see. You may put it into memory, and you may delay it, and so on. But essentially, what you see is comparatively rich, not as rich as people feel, and it can be used for various purposes by your brain.
My guest today is Dr. Francis Crick, recipient with James Watson of the Nobel Prize in Physiology. Dr. Crick is currently a distinguished research professor at the Salk Institute. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Now, we've had Steve Coslin from Harvard on the program, the author of Wet Mind, for our listeners, and we asked him this question, and now we're going to ask you. Now, recognizing some clear differences in biochemistry, and political correctness be darned here, do you see any difference between the functioning in the brains of women versus the brains of men?
Well, it's not something that I know that much about, but of course it is well known that on an average, now you have to be careful about on an average men are taller than women.
Yes,
this
is true.
The fact that you get a tall, occasionally get tall women and short men doesn't alter the average. So we're talking about on an average. Now, I don't know what Steve said, but one of the differences is that they're not so good at rotating things in their heads. Like reading maps. It's a common observation of husbands that their wives often, but not always, often can't read maps. And certainly not if the maps are upside down. And so that's one difference. Of course, there are a lot of difference connected with sex, you know.
That's true.
I mean, people do, as you see at puberty, they respond to certain aspects of people after puberty, which they're often largely indifferent to before. So that's certainly a difference, and that's so common that it isn't normally mentioned. Whether there are other differences, I wouldn't like to say, because I really haven't looked into the subject carefully.
Well, just for the record, Steve dodged it.
Dodged
the question.
Really?
Well, I think in reading your book, as well as his, what came to mind is there was a clear biochemical element to look at. It's not just electrons and synapses. There was this leap through chemistry or no man's land. Chemistry is not my field, so I don't know. So I kept thinking to myself, there are such biochemical differences between men and women. Why wouldn't there be some presence of that in the brain? And maybe there isn't. But
there are, but I think you should think of the brain in I was going to say two ways, but they're interrelated. The brain is mainly a signaling machine. It is sending signals from one nerve cell to another. Now, those signals are electrical, but they're not like the signals that go down an electrical wire, as it happens. They're what's called electrochemical, without going into all the details. They send, as pulses sent down out from a nerve cell down its so-called axon, and that pulse is regenerative, so it's the same strength at the end as at the beginning. It's like having a repeater circuit if you're in an electrical one. So it's sensible really to concentrate on that, on the electrical side and the signaling, and that's the important part. Now the complication comes is that when you come to the end of the axon, it has to communicate. It branches in many ways. The signal goes to all the branches, starts off as one along one line and branches to many, and then each of those has to join onto another nerve cell. It's what's called a synapse. And you might think that since it's electrical, and since the effect it produces on the next nerve cell is electrical, that that's a totally electrical process. But that's not the way nature does it. The signal comes down electrical, in an electrical form, electrochemical form. It then releases a little packets of chemical, which go across a very small gap to the next nerve cell, sit on special receptor molecules there, which then open holes in the membrane which let charged atoms, ions, in and out, and that gives the electrical effect. So that you go, the signal comes down electrical, then it becomes chemical, and then it becomes electrical. Now, many of the things that you hear about, like Valium or Prozac or things like that, and sleeping pills, all those things, they're interfering with that little chemical step. They're going sitting on the receptors there and either boosting them up or calming them down or whatever it is. And there are systems of the brain which just do that. They alter your mood and things and keeps you awake and asleep and so on. So it's chemical in that sense, but it's chemical because it's influencing the signaling behavior.
You say in the book that we have not yet discovered how to correctly conceptualize consciousness. What's missing?
I don't say the ideas may be perfectly adequate as we get more experimental information. But we have to be open to the possibility that we have to rethink our ideas. But that's common in science. As you go along and as new experiments come in, you refine your ideas. That's why it's important not to try and give a definition of consciousness at the beginning. Because whatever you do is likely to be too restrictive and misleading. You should just have a rough idea and, as it were, fumble your way forward until you eventually see things much more clearly.
At the end of your book, in the section you called Dr. Crick's Sunday Morning Service,
which is a takeoff, incidentally, of T.S. Eliot. There's a poem by him with a similar title.
You say, if the scientific facts are sufficiently striking and well-established, and if they support the astonishing hypothesis, then it will be possible to argue that the idea that man has a disembodied soul is as unnecessary as the old idea that there was a life force. Now, when I read your book, I did not find incompatible everything that you said and the idea that, well, we were talking about reincarnation earlier, mm-hmm. that at some moment, very early in the womb perhaps, there could be a spark and a loading of a database in your brain. I mean, just arguably. And then throughout life, your brain is administering your database, and then at the end, it goes off and does something else.
Yes, but what is it like when you go off and do something else? You see, the people have asked me, well, what about what do they call it, out-of-body experiences, which people have often when they're near death and so on, where they report that they were sort of up on the ceiling and could look down and see themselves. To my mind, that's almost inconceivable. Because if you close your eyes, you can't see anything. And presumably, if you think you have a soul, that can't see anything either. So how is it going to do the seeing if it's up there on the ceiling? So I can only answer as we said before. Of course, you can invent these things. You can invent a life force. But the life force will probably not do anything that you can't explain in terms of physics and chemistry. So it becomes a superfluous hypothesis. Now, we haven't got to that stage yet. That's why it's called a hypothesis.
Dr. Crick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest today has been Dr. Francis Crick. He received the Nobel Prize for Physiology for his co-discovery of the double helix structure of DNA. His latest book is The Astonishing Hypothesis, The Scientific Search for the Soul, published by Charles Scribner Sons. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. The Dead Sea Scrolls have been the subject of controversy and mystery. Independent of the intrigue, we wanted to know what science could tell us about the scrolls. I spoke with Doris Hamburg, head of paper conservation for the Library of Congress and currently the conservator for the Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit visiting the United States. I asked her to tell me about them.
The Dead Sea Scrolls are a whole group of fragments and scrolls that were found in the area of the Dead Sea beginning in 1947. There are about 800 texts that are represented among the thousands and thousands of fragments that are called the Dead Sea Scrolls. And some of them are very small fragments, and some of them are full scrolls. And the scrolls themselves are, for the most part, on skin material that resembles in part parchment and in part leather. Because of the way that they were made, they have the characteristics of both. There are also some scrolls that are fragments that are on papyrus. All the scrolls that we have in the show are on skin material, and they range in size from several feet to just a few inches in size. And part of the interesting challenges about the scrolls is how all these fragments fit together and what they're actually saying.
How old are the scrolls?
They range in age from about 200 BCE, or before the Common Era, to about 70 in the Common Era. Common Era is used in the same way that AD is used.
So it's BC, AD.
Right.
BCE. Before Common Era.
Right. And AD. And Common Era is AD.
Is AD.
Or CE is AD. Right.
So they're ranging in several hundred years there. Who made them?
That's one of the questions that we don't, I think, totally know the answers. And the scholars who have been working on the scrolls for decades are the ones to answer that question. I think you'd probably get different answers if you speak to different people. Some theories are that they were written in the community of Qumran, which is very near the caves, near the Dead Sea. And others feel that they may have been written by scribes in Jerusalem. But they're not signed for the most part, really, and so we don't have an exact answer at this point.
Now, remembering at this point in time, this was the only way to really record something other than in stone.
Right, or in pottery.
Ah.
Right. And they are written extremely clearly. The ink that we see on them is, for the most part, black, although there's a few areas where there's red ink. And the writing varies a lot from one scroll to the other. You can see in some small writing and others much larger, and certainly they're different hands. Certainly within that time frame, you would expect many different scribes. The languages also vary. Some are in Hebrew, some are in Aramaic. I think there's also Greek. And they represent many different sources, I think, at least in terms of how they were made.
What's on the scrolls? What do they say?
The texts include biblical texts. There are commentaries on biblical texts. They're sectarian.
By sectarian?
Not necessarily specifically biblically oriented. There's a document that relates to the calendar and how it was based on the solar calendar, whereas the typical Jewish calendar was a lunar calendar. So this is an interesting aspect of having found a scroll that or text that refers to a different kind of calendar that may have been in use at the time.
I think most people have in their minds there was this shepherd boy, and he took a rock and threw it in a cave and heard, I guess, pottery shatter.
Right.
But there were many caves involved, and it took a number of years to discover what's now collected into the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, my understanding is that initially the first discovery was made, and the scrolls were offered to a dealer who then tried to find purchase. Initially, they found a couple of scrolls and then later went back and found more in that cave. But then over time, the archaeologists and also Bedouins were looking for different scrolls when it became clear that this was something that was of interest to people. And then the Jordanian government, I think, authorized actually the excavations that would be feasible. So over time, they were trying to find as many as they could. I think the Israeli Antiquities Authority has been interested in trying to find out if there are more caves still that maybe haven't been discovered to date.
How many scrolls are there?
Fragments, there are tens of thousands.
Of small little
some things. Very small, couple of inches, others larger. They're about seven or so of a larger size. That depends on how you define scrolls, actually, in terms of length. But we are talking about tens of thousands. As I mentioned, there are about 800 texts that are covered, and they're not all complete texts. And some are duplicate, the same text but written in several different scrolls.
My guest today is Doris Hamburg, head of paper conservation at the Library of Congress, and conservator for the Dead Sea Scrolls exhibition now here in the United States. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. We talked a little about this earlier. The scrolls themselves are some kind of, would you say, leather?
They're generally called parchment, but they have leather. There's an aspect of them that is leather-like, yes, because the parchment was tanned partially. And so that's where it sort of has qualities of both.
Parchment. What do you mean?
Is it parchment? Parchment is all a skin material that is softened by putting it in certain materials, and then stretched. So the fibers align themselves and they create this material that we call parchment. But if you were to expose the parchment to a lot of moisture, it would actually sort of be just like the skin that it came off when it started. Leather, on the other hand, is put into tanning materials, and that changes the actual skin chemically. And so it gets another quality altogether. And you can't go backwards that way. It's kind of irreversible. And the Dead Sea Scrolls have, it seems, been tanned partially. And so that's why they're somewhere in the middle. But generally, we talk about them as parchment.
But they start with skin.
Yes. Right.
Sheepskin?
Goats and sheep.
Those animals that live in the area.
Right, exactly.
And they're partially tanned. Are we talking about something that's brittle? Are we talking about something that's very flexible?
At this point, a lot of them are fairly brittle and very fragile. And certainly when they were originally made, I don't think they would have been that brittle.
How did you know how old they were?
They've been dated through carbon-14 dating. The dates, initially the carbon-14 dating was done on linen fragments that were found with the scrolls, because the scrolls were rolled up and wrapped in linen. And those, in some cases, were also put in these clay jars that people have seen, and they'll be in the exhibit as well. And that linen provided something for dating. As time went on, the carbon-14 dating has become more sophisticated, and it's been possible to date them in the time period of about 200 years before the Common Era and about 70 years after.
Now, geographically speaking, we're talking the Dead Sea, we're talking a desert here.
That's right.
How well have these scrolls been preserved? Can we tell?
I think it's pretty miraculous. I think these are the oldest known skin materials that have been found. And to think that these organic materials really have survived 2,000 years is pretty amazing. It's largely attributed to the fact that they were in the caves in a fairly dry environment that didn't go through a lot of environmental changes. It didn't have a lot of fluctuations in humidity. That's our general theory about it.
It's been a number of years, decades, since they were first discovered.
Mm-hmm.
What has gone on to conserve the scrolls?
Well, initially when the scrolls were found, people didn't really have an exact sense of how to best take care of them. And the scrolls were put by the scholars when they were doing research between two plates of glass. And they would put these plates of glass with the scrolls between them on very long tables, because one of the big jobs they had at hand was to piece all the fragments together to know what went with what. These were held together then, unfortunately, with Scotch tape, or the equivalent of Scotch tape.
Well,
at that
let's
time.
Just put that Scotch tape on these.
Right. And unfortunately, Scotch tape really doesn't hold up well at all. And the adhesive goes into whatever it's holding, and it causes deterioration of the skin and so on. So, unfortunately, the scrolls were Scotch taped together, and they were held in these glass plates, which also is a problem because it's easy for condensation to occur against the glass when they're held directly against the glass. They also were not in a controlled relative humidity and temperature, which are other issues that are problems. And they had a certain amount of shifting back and forth to different locations, I understand. But in the last few years, the effort has been the Israeli Antiquity Authority set up a conservation lab, and they've been working to remove them from the glass plates and also to remove the Scotch tape or sellotape. And that's a very time-consuming, very labor-intensive job, because each scroll is different one from the next. It's not a wholesale process. You have to do it item by item. And the way they go about this is they need to look at each individual scroll, and they do a very a condition report to evaluate its condition and see what are the issues with that particular fragment. And then they need to test it to find out how the tape will react so that they can remove it with something that's appropriate. They don't want to, of course, harm the scroll, and they also need to remove the tape.
So they're trying to remove anything that's happened to them since they were found.
That's right.
And now the issues are constant temperature, constant humidity.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, we're hoping we're going to preserve them.
Right. Another factor is the light. And because organic materials are subject to degradation from light, they need to be kept under very controlled lighting conditions. And that's something we've been thinking a lot in terms of this exhibit. We needed to keep the light levels low, enough so people could see, but low enough that we would not feel like we would be hastening the degradation unduly. So that is another factor.
Well, let's talk about the exhibit. You were involved from the beginning. The mm-hmm. Dead Sea Scrolls have not come to the United States recently.
Right.
Pretty exciting to see. And tell us about how that started and where they have been and will be here in the United States.
Well, the Library of Congress was involved from the beginning of this exhibit, and I was asked to participate, and that involved going to Israel and working with the Israelis at the Antiquities Authority to try and work out a system that we could use so that they could travel safely. And I proposed a system that would be a modular system that would hold the scrolls safely so that they wouldn't move around in the course of travel or during the exhibit. And what we did was we put them between two layers of polyester netting, and they're held in place by sewing outside that the fragments. It doesn't go through the fragments at all.
Sort of like a pouch.
Exactly.
Stitching on the end.
And the netting's very fine. You can see it in certain angles of light, but generally you can see through it very well. And that's held in a number of layers that help to control the environment as well. We have some organic materials, mat boards and so on, inside acid-free materials, and plexiglass and polypropylene board on the top and bottom so you can look through it. And basically this forms a kind of modular package that we've been able to start with and not disturb throughout the course of the trip, because we really did not want to have to manipulate the scrolls in any way while they were in this traveling exhibition. And so far it's worked very well. We've been very pleased with it.
So the packaging was part of the display then?
That's right. And so we needed to think about it from an aesthetic point of view as well.
And they were sealed in Israel
mm-hmm.
and then traveled. So where did they
travel? We provided the materials at the Library of Congress. We shipped all the materials to Israel, and then they were assembled there.
What's the biggest size? I mean, we're talking small to large. I mean, some of these have to be pretty big.
The scrolls that are on exhibit right now, the biggest scroll in terms of the amount of writing is the Psalm scroll, and that measures about 33 inches wide, and it's about 7.25 inches high. And what's really wonderful about that is it's one whole panel from a scroll. There would have been a number of panels sewn together, and that's what would have been rolled. And we can see that this is a whole panel because the holes that would have been used to sew it together at each side are still there. And you can look and see those holes when you look at the fragment. The other scroll that's a little bit longer is the Leviticus scroll.
So you've got how many scrolls came over?
We have 12.
12. How many of the fragments have been analyzed and put together at this point? Have they all been assembled?
A large number of the scrolls have been published. And there's still some that haven't been published, and the Israel Antiquities Authority has a schedule for their publication that will be happening over the next years.
Well, there has been a great amount of mystery with all of this, and I know in the last 3 years there's even more mystery. Some of the microfilms, I believe, the scrolls were released in an unauthorized form.
Mm-hmm.
It would seem to me that technology in terms of scanning the fragments would enable them to work with the scrolls more readily than mm-hmm. having to deal with them directly. Do you know what's going on in that?
One of the sources for working with the scrolls, in addition to the scrolls themselves, has actually been a whole series of photographs. And there have been publications now of the scroll fragments, and that's from the photographs that were taken in the very beginning. In addition to the photographs that were taken with regular light, there are also photographs that were taken with infrared. And that the infrared illumination helps to differentiate the ink from the background, and it often clarifies the writing that's on the scroll fragment itself. And those have been particularly valuable to scholars in trying to work out the texts.
It's not just the video or the visual image. The infrared will enhance the image.
Exactly. It will do that. And there's been work that's been going on here in California as well to further enhance that using computer-assisted digitization to work with, to enhance the infrared aspect of looking at the scrolls.
My guest today is Doris Hamburg, conservator for the Dead Sea Scrolls exhibition here in the United States. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. In each of the three places, the Library of Congress, New York Public Library, and now here at the Young Museum in San Francisco, each of those exhibits had a slightly different flavor. In addition to the scrolls, they displayed other materials. Tell us about that.
There's a whole range of materials that are accompanying the scroll to help give a sense of the life at Qumran and the community near the where the caves were found. These include a number of things. There are combs that were used by people at that time. They look like combs, a type of comb that we use today. There are fragments from baskets, which also are amazing because if you go to a market in the Middle East, the same kind of pattern is used in weaving a basket. So some things change very slowly. The leather tabs that were used in the beginning of a scroll, a leather tab would be attached to the scroll fragment, and then a leather thong would be threaded through that. And that leather thong was then used to wrap around the scroll itself to hold it and tie it. And those are on the exhibit as well. And one of the scroll fragments that's in the exhibit from the prayer for King Jonathan still has that leather tab on it, and you can see that. Other kinds of things include cooking pots, plates. There is a group of bowls or goblets, as they're called, which were actually found in a stack in the earth. And they were just stacked in a group and have fused over time. And so that whole stack is in the exhibit as well. You can see them just as they came out of the earth. And probably someone put this pile in a corner and went off or did whatever it did. There's also an inkwell that was thought may have been used to write some of the fragments.
Now, we've been talking about the deterioration of the parchments or the skins, the scrolls themselves. What about the inks?
Many of the inks are in very good condition and are very black and show up very well. One of the things one does in some cases, I think if something with moisture, if it had been exposed to moisture at some point, there may have been some offsetting onto the, if it was a scroll, that there may have been offsetting of the ink onto the back of what it was rolled against. But the inks seem, in many cases, to be very good condition.
Is it standard ink?
The ink is thought to have been, or based on the testing so far, seems to have been a carbon ink. So something like black soot mixed with perhaps a gum. And this is a type of formula that's been used over centuries. And it would have been, the ink would have been written, used in writing with a reed pen. And that's how they would have, they could cut the reed pen to make a nib so that you could write on the skin itself.
When they would go to write on these scrolls, I mean, their skins, were they squared off? You know, we get our paper all very nicely squared off, but skins don't come that way.
Right. My sense is there was definitely a certain amount of squaring off based on the fact that we see panels and so on, and of course the animal, as you're saying, wasn't squared off. Whether it was completely squared off top to bottom, I'm not sure about that, but there certainly was in that, it was in that direction.
I see that there's at least one case where the two panels were sewn hand sewn together.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's how they would continue to put the panels.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there is in one of the panels in the exhibit, in one of the fragments, that you can see parts of two panels, and the original linen thread that was used to hold them together is there. And they also, if they didn't use linen thread, they might have also used sinews, animal sinew, to sew it together.
How different are the scrolls? Is the handwriting many different sizes, different styles?
There are many different styles of writing, it seems, from what I've seen of the scrolls. And some are very small writing, some are much bigger writing. Some are very precise and clear, and we can see in others that it's less clear and it seems harder to read. So that clearly suggests the many different scribes involved. That's where the infrared photographs sometimes are helpful. And of course, the people who are reading this are experts in the paleography of the scrolls themselves. Paleography is another very important part. We spoke about carbon dating. But paleography is another very important part in dating the scrolls, because there's from various sources knowledge of how the alphabets were at different time periods, and knowing that has helped also in dating the scrolls themselves. So it's a combination of science, but also the paleographic.
And by that mean that the history of letters developing and
yes.
styles of writing?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Well, you were saying that you did a lot of planning and developed the housing and all of that. Still, things do go wrong with technology. How do you know over the course of the travel and the various exhibits that there hasn't been a problem with the scrolls themselves?
Well, we're constantly monitoring the scrolls. We began with looking at them before they were housed, and then once they were housed, we also continued the condition reporting. It's something we call condition reporting, and we do that at the very beginning, and we do that at each time when it goes to each new place. When it came to the Library of Congress, we looked at it and we reported on the condition of it. While it was in each of the exhibits, we are monitoring the relative humidity, the temperature, and the light also to make sure that they're the way we want them. And we're also building into the exhibit safeguards, so that we're inside the cases for the exhibits, we have a method of maintaining the relative humidity. So the museum here and the libraries in both places have generally good environments, but we also put in a backup system so that if there would be a problem, that we could help control it from internal to the case itself. So that's another way that we're trying to control the system and make sure that we're not seeing changes. But again, it comes off exhibit, we report condition. It travels to the new venue, we look at it again. And we're constantly doing this to make sure that there are no problems and trying to... The planning part that you mentioned at the beginning is really important. And also having excellent staff at each one of the venues that we've been at really made a difference as well.
Well, people say, oh, well, okay, so you get the constant temperature, you get relative humidity, it can't be that hard. It's like, well, you put 200 or 300 people in a room, controlling mm-hmm. the relative humidity is a major problem.
Right, you're right, and that's technology. But that's certainly the staffs, I think, at each of the institutions have been aware of those issues and trying to safeguard against the issues, but that's why we put silica gel in each of the cases, because that's able to contain that. We're making the environment around the scrolls a smaller environment that we're able to control through that passive system. Mm-hmm. And then the scrolls themselves are in another package that further has a safeguard in protecting the changes. So we actually have three systems that are working in our favor.
Now, have you yourself touched with your hands a scroll?
Yes, I have.
Yes. See, nobody else will get to that I talked to. So
right.
What did it feel like?
Well, I can't say I touched it a lot because we try not to do that. But
you couldn't help yourself, though,
right,
did you?
Right. But they're very fragile. There's no question
about it.
Are
they thin?
They're thin for the most part, but they are not all the same. Remember that they were made over that long time period. So they vary in appearance. One of the things that the visitors who have seen the scrolls or will see the scrolls will be aware of it. Some are very light, some are very dark. The appearance is matte on some, but more shiny in others. So they do vary a lot. But I'd say overall we think of the scrolls as being very fragile, and they can, you could break off pieces on some of them. Others are more flexible.
Now, when you touched it, when you held it in your hand, was that exciting?
Yes, it was very exciting. It was very, very exciting. I mean, and then also I was very fortunate to have the opportunity to go to Qumran and to be in that environment and to think that the scrolls were found very close to there. You could look over and see the caves, and there'll be photographs, and there have been photographs in all the exhibits of the area, and you get a real flavor of what it might have been like 2,000 years ago when people were walking around living their life at that time and creating these scrolls.
Doris, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
My guest today has been Doris Hamburg. She's the head of paper conservation at the Library of Congress, and she's conservator for the Dead Sea Scrolls exhibition here in the United States. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Evan's perspective today is called Keeping the Faith.
I'm taping this on Monday. It says so on our bathroom calendar, and the daily newspaper has Monday at the top of every page, so it must be true. When we agree to call today Monday, that is, Moon Day, we're keeping the faith. This particular faith, which dates back to 100 or so years before Christ, maintains that every seventh day is ruled by the moon. For over 2,000 years, without missing a single day, most people whose cultures stem back to ancient Mediterranean civilizations have acknowledged every seventh day to be the moon's. Like an endless chain letter, the cycle of days of the week has been maintained faithfully by the Greeks, Romans, Angles, Saxons, Vikings, Normans, and all the rest who came before us. We just happen to be the latest generation to keep the faith. You might want to think about that when the alarm goes off in the morning and you're lying there trying to remember what day it is. As evidence of what a powerful icon the cyclical seven-day week is in our culture, consider what happened in 1582. That's when Pope Gregory XIII instituted the calendar reform, which is still in use today. Although he changed the dates, he left the sequence of days alone. The problem that needed to be fixed was this. In the previous Julian system, the average length of the calendar year was about 11 minutes longer than the natural year. The error had built up over the centuries, so that by 1582, the date was out of sync with the seasons by about 10 days. To bring the calendar back into line with nature, he ordered that October the 4th, 1582, which happened to be a Thursday, would be followed by October the 15th. Now, if the 4th of a month is a Thursday, the 15th should be a Monday. But the Pope declared that the 15th was to be a Friday, because Friday always follows Thursday. Even the Pope was unwilling to mess with the order of days, in particular the biblical injunction that every seventh day was the Lord's Day.
Barry Evans writes the syndicated column Star Watch, and he's the author of Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.